breadths of his tunic and shove him to the ground, pinning his forearms to the crossbeam with their knees. The executioner probed the underside of Jesus' wrist, searching for the hollow space between the bones, though I could not understand then why the soldier pushed his fingers into that soft place like a woman who rummages in her bread dough for some small dropped object. He raised his hammer and drove a nail through that small opening into the wood. The cry that left Jesus sent his mother to her knees, but somehow I went on standing there, muttering, "Sophia, Sophia, Sophia," as the other wrist was probed and the nail driven. The crossbeam was lifted up and its notch fitted onto the upright. Jesus writhed a moment and kicked the air as the crossbeam fell into place with a jolt. The soldiers gathered his knees together, bending them slightly, and then with studied precision arranged his right foot over his left. A single nail was pounded through them both. I don't remember that he made any sound. I remember the vicious, hollow thud of the hammer and the wail it set off in my head. I closed my eyes, feeling I was abandoning him by retreating into the dark behind my lids. The wail slapped like waves against the inside of my skull. Then came the sound of laughter, far away and strange. I forced my eyes open, allowing in a painful slat of light. A soldier was nailing a pinewood placard above Jesus' head and finding merriment in it. "What does it say?" Mary of Magdala asked. "Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews," I read. It was written in Hebrew, Aramaic, and Latin, lest anyone miss their mockery. From behind us, someone shouted, "If you're the King of the Jews, save yourself." "He helped others, can't he help himself?" cried another. Salome slid her arm around Mary's waist and drew her mother to her side. "May God take him quickly," she said. "And where is God?" I wanted to scream. "Wasn't he supposed to establish his kingdom now? And the people, why didn't they revolt as Judas had expected? Instead, they jeered at Jesus." "If you're the Messiah, come down from the cross and save yourself," a man yelled. Indignant, I whirled about to rebuke the rabble and glimpsed my brother standing alone on the edge of the hill. Seeing that I'd caught sight of him, he stretched out his hands to me, pleading, it seemed, for mercy. "Anna, forgive me." I stared, astonished by the sight of him, by how misguided he'd been, by how callous his zeal and sense of righteousness had become. I searched myself for the fury I'd felt toward him earlier, but it had left me. I tried to summon it, but it had retreated at the sight of him standing there so lost and bereft. A premonition swept through me that I would not see Judas again. I crossed my hands over my chest and nodded at him. It was not forgiveness I sent. It was pity. As I drew my eyes back to Jesus, he struggled to lift himself up in order to take a breath. The sight nearly broke me. After that, all sense of time left me. I didn't know whether minutes passed or hours. Jesus went on heaving himself up and gasping for air. Thunder rumbled on and off over the Mount of Olives. Salome and the three Marys knelt on the dirt and intoned the Psalms, while I watched Jesus from the dark, sorrowful doorway of my heart and uttered not a word. From time to time, Jesus muttered something, but I couldn't hear what he said. He seemed far away and alone. Twice I tried to go to him, and both times the soldiers forced me back. A man also attempted to approach Jesus, calling, "Jesus, Master!" and he too was turned away. I looked back once for Judas. He was gone. At mid-afternoon, the soldiers, bored with the slowness of his dying, left their posts and squatted some distance from the cross, where they began to throw dice. I did not hesitate. I broke into a run. As I stood beneath the cross, the closeness of him shocked me. His breath rasped and raked through his chest. His legs rippled with spasms. Heat and sweat were streaming from his body. I reached for the timber, then drew back my hand, repulsed by it. I took a deep breath and gazed up at him. "Jesus." His head slumped toward his shoulder, and I saw he was looking at me. He didn't speak, nor did I. But I told myself later that everything that had ever passed between us was present then, that it was hidden somewhere among the suffering. Mary rushed to him, followed by the others. She wrapped her hands about her son's feet like she was holding a tiny bird that had fallen from its nest. I wrapped my hands about hers, and then the other three women did the same, our hands like the petals of a lotus. Not one of us wept. We stood there mute and full and held up that flower for him. The soldiers did not tear themselves from their game of knuckle bones to chase us away. They no longer seemed to care we were there. We watched Jesus' eyes grow glassy and distant. I felt the moment come, the severing. It was gentle, like a touch on the shoulder. "It is finished," Jesus said. There was a sound like a rush of wings in the blackish clouds, and I knew his spirit had left him. I imagined it like a great flock of birds, soaring, scattering, coming to rest everywhere. 5. We prepared Jesus for burial by the flicker of two oil lamps. Kneeling on the cave floor beside his body, I felt oddly numb. How could this be my husband? I looked at the other women in the tomb as if observing them from a corner of the sky. Mary, his mother, was cleansing his feet and legs while the others sang the songs of lament. Their faces were smeared and wet, their voices bounding and rebounding off the cave walls. A towel and a ewer of water sat beside me, waiting for me to join them in readying him for burial. "Pick up the towel. Pick it up." But gazing at it, I was seized with panic. I understood that if I took hold of the towel, if I touched Jesus, I would fall from my niche in the sky. His dying would become real. Grief would swallow me. My eyes wandered to the stacks of bones at the back of the cave, neatly separated into skulls, ribs, long bones, short bones, fingers, toes, countless dead people mingled together in a morbid communion. No one who'd been buried here, it seemed, had the means to purchase an ossuary to hold their bones. This was a pauper's tomb. We were fortunate to have any tomb at all. Rome's custom was to leave a crucified man hanging on the cross for weeks, then toss his body into a pit to finish decaying. Jesus would have suffered that abomination except for the goodness of a stranger. He'd been no older than Jesus and adorned in an expensive robe and finely dyed blue hat. He'd approached us moments after a soldier thrust a spear into Jesus' side to ensure his death. The act had sickened and appalled me, and I swung away, turning my back on the gruesome scene, almost careening into the man. His eyes were red and weighted. He said, "I've located a tomb not far from here. If I can convince the centurion to turn over Jesus' body, my servants will take him there." I eyed him. "Who are you, sir?" "I'm one of Jesus' followers. My name is Joseph. I come from Arimathea. You women must be his family." Mary stepped forward. "I'm his mother. And I'm his wife," I told him. "Your kindness is welcome." He bowed slightly and strode off, tugging a money bag from his sash. He placed a denarius in the centurion's palm. I watched it grow into a column of silver. When he returned to us, he held out more denarii. "Go into the city and purchase what you need to prepare the body. But you must hurry. The centurion wishes to hand over the body quickly." He glanced up into the half-light. "And he has to be buried before sunset. The Sabbath will be upon us soon." Salome scooped the coins from his hand, and grabbing Mary of Bethany by the hand, she pulled her down the hillside. "We'll wait for you here. Be quick," he called after them. Now, in the cave, the lamp flames darted. Light spattered across Jesus' skin. His skin. His. I reached out and touched it. I let my fingers brush the inside of his elbow. Then I dampened the towel and wiped the dirt and blood from his hands, arms, chest, and face. From the coils of his ears and the creases in his neck. All the while falling and falling, slamming into myself, into the boundless pain. We rubbed his skin with olive oil, then anointed him with nothing but myrrh. It had been the only sweet spice Salome had been able to obtain in the city at the late hour, and this had dismayed Mary. "When the Sabbath ends," she said, "we'll return to the tomb and anoint him more properly with cloves and aloe and mint." I watched Salome draw a broken wooden comb through his hair. I'd witnessed his slaughter, and not a tear had crossed my cheeks, but I cried in silence now at the comb passing through his locks. Mary of Magdala grasped the edges of the shroud and drew it slowly down the length of him, but in that last instant before his face was gone from me, I bent and kissed both his cheeks. "I will meet you in the place called Deathless," I whispered. 6. That evening, Martha turned the Sabbath meal into the funeral feast. But no one cared to eat. We were sitting on the damp courtyard tiles, huddled beneath a canopy. All around us were the coming dark and the plop of rain drizzle. And silence, a great, stunned silence. No one had spoken of Jesus since we'd left the tomb. We had squeezed through the cave opening where Lavi waited for us, heaved the stone across it, and left our voices inside. Then we'd walked slowly to Bethany, shocked, weary, mute with horror, I still barefoot, and Lavi carrying my sandals. I looked at them now, Mary and Salome, Lazarus, Mary, and Martha, Mary of Magdala, Tabitha, and Lavi. They stared back with solemn, devastated faces. Jesus is dead. I wished for Yalfa, for Diadora and Skepsis. I forced myself to picture them beneath the tamarisk tree, beside the little stone hut. I tried to see the bright white cliffs at the top of the hill, and Lake Mariotis shining at the foot of it like a piece of fallen sky. I managed to hold all of this in my mind for several moments before the ghastly memories pushed their way back in. I didn't know how the rubble inside me could ever be put back together. As the night drew around us, Martha lit 3 lamps and set them in our midst. All of their faces shone suddenly, cheeks and chins the color of honey. The rain finally stopped. Far away, I heard the mournful call of an owl. The sound caused a pressure in my throat, and I realized it was the need to fashion a story, to call into the blackness like the owl. I broke the silence. I told them about the letter Judas had sent summoning me home. He wrote to me that Jesus was in danger from the authorities, but I know now that most of that danger came from Judas himself. I hesitated, feeling a mix of disgust and shame. It was my brother who led the temple guard to arrest Jesus. "How do you know this?" exclaimed Lazarus. "I encountered him this morning in the Garden of Gethsemane. He confessed it to me." "May God strike him down," Martha said with fierceness. No one refuted her, not even I. I watched their sharp, appalled expressions, how they struggled to comprehend. Mary of Magdala gave her head a shake, the amber light catching in her hair. She lifted her face to me, and I wondered if she knew why I'd not traveled with my husband through the villages and towns around Galilee as she'd done. Were the circumstances of my exile known among his followers? Was I known among them? "It's impossible that Judas would betray Jesus," the Magdalene said. "He loved him. I traveled with the disciples for months. Judas was devoted to Jesus." I bristled. I may not have been there for Jesus' ministry, but I knew my brother. I responded tersely. "I know very well that Judas loved Jesus. He loved him like a brother. But he hated Rome far more." A look crossed her face, something crestfallen, and my annoyance vanished. Even then I knew I'd snapped at her out of envy, resentful of the freedom she'd had to follow Jesus around the countryside, while I'd been trapped in Haran's house. "I shouldn't have spoken harshly," I told her. She smiled and the skin wrinkled around her eyes in that way that makes a woman beautiful. There came another silence. My mother-in-law placed her hand on my arm, her fingers brushing past the bloodstain on the sleeve of Jesus' cloak. She had aged deeply in the 2 years I'd been gone. Her hair was silvering, and her face had begun to change into an old woman's, the plump, sagging cheeks, eyelids slumped under her lashes. She rubbed my arm, meant to comfort, but her fingers woke the smells inside the cloak's fabric. Sweat, cook smoke, wine, spikenard. The sense, so sudden and alive, unleashed a bitter pain inside me, and I understood that I'd spoken to them about Judas because I couldn't bear to speak about Jesus. I feared it. I feared the power it had to unlock pain from common places. There was so much, though, to be said, to be understood. I shifted, straightened. I was on my way to the palace this morning when I came upon Jesus in the street carrying the crossbeam. I know nothing about how he came to be condemned or why he wore those dreadful thorns on his head. I looked at the women who'd climbed Golgotha with me. Were any of you there when he was brought before Pilate? Mary of Magdala leaned toward me. We were all there. When I arrived, a large crowd had already gathered on the pavement, and Jesus was standing above us on the porch, where the Roman governor pronounces his judgments. Pilate was questioning him, but from where I stood, it was impossible to hear what was said. We could not hear him either, said Salome, though for most of it Jesus remained silent, refusing to answer Pilate's questions. You could tell this aggravated Pilate. Eventually, he shouted for Jesus to be taken to Herod Antipas. At the mention of Antipas's name, fear, then hate, blazed up in me. Jesus and I had been forced apart for 2 years because of him. Why would Pilate send Jesus to Antipas? I asked. Mary of Magdala said, I heard some in the crowd say Pilate would prefer Antipas to pronounce the verdict and save him from blame in case people revolted and blood was shed. He could be recalled to Rome over an outcome like that. Better to wash his hands of it and let the Tetrarch do it. We waited on the pavement to see what would happen, and sometime later, Jesus returned with the thorn crown on his head and a purple cape about his shoulders. Salome said, It was awful, Anna. Antipas had costumed Jesus like that to mock him as king of the Jews. Pilate's soldiers were bowing to him and laughing. I could see that he'd been flogged. He could hardly stand, but he kept his head lifted the whole time and didn't flinch at their ridicule. Her face was radiant with the urge to cry. Who condemned him to die, Antipas or Pilate? Asked Lazarus, clasping and unclasping his hands. It was Pilate, said Mary of Magdala. He addressed the crowd, saying it was the custom during Passover to release one prisoner. I cannot tell you how my hope leapt at this. I thought he intended to set Jesus free. Instead, he asked the crowd who it should be, Jesus or someone else. We women had arrived at the palace separately, but by this time we'd found one another and we shouted Jesus' name as loudly as we could. But there were many followers present of a man named Barabbas, a zealot held in Antonia's tower for insurrection. They screamed his name until that was all that could be heard. The knowledge that Jesus might have been saved at the end but wasn't staggered me. If I'd been there, if I'd left my bed earlier, if I'd not delayed in the Garden of Gethsemane, I would have been there to fill the air with his name. It happened so fast, Mary said, turning to me. Pilate pointed his finger at Jesus and said, Crucify him. I closed my eyes to keep out the picture that tortured me most, but the image could move through walls and eyelids and every conceivable barrier, and I saw my beloved nailed to the Roman timbers, trying to lift himself up to take a sip of air. Was this what it was like to grieve a husband? A memory came to me, a small one, a foolish one. Mary, do you remember when Judith traded Delilah for a bolt of cloth? I remember it well, said Mary. I had never seen you so distressed. I looked at the others, wanting them to understand. You see, I had charge of the animals, and Delilah was more than a goat. She was my pet. Now she's become my pet, said Mary. I felt a momentary elation. Delilah was still there and being pampered. Judith hated the goat, I said. I think what she hated was how much she loved it, Salome added. It's true Judith liked me only slightly better than Delilah, but for her to take the goat to Sepphoris and trade her without telling me, I'd not expected it. When I confronted her, she argued that the cloth she'd acquired was fine linen, better than she could weave, and that James had recently brought home a new, younger goat, making Delilah unnecessary. Everyone must have wondered why I was telling them this. They listened and nodded in an indulgent way. The aftermath of tragedy is strange, their expressions said. Her husband has just been crucified. Let her say whatever peculiar thing she needs to say. I continued. Jesus arrived home the same day Judith traded the goat, after a long, exhausting trek from Capernaum, where he'd worked all week. He found me distraught. It was late afternoon and he'd not eaten, but he turned around and walked all the way to Sepphoris and bought Delilah back with the coins he'd earned that week. Mary's eyes glittered. He came through the gate carrying Delilah on his shoulders. Yes, he did, I exclaimed. He brought her back to me. I could still see him, grinning as he strode toward me across the compound, Delilah bleeding wildly, and the picture was as vivid to me as the one of him crucified. Leaning my head back, I breathed as deeply as I could. Overhead, a ragged blanket of clouds, the moon somewhere, hidden. The owl had flown away. Mary said, "Tell them the rest of it." I hadn't intended to say anything further, but I was glad to do as she said. The following week, Judith dyed her new fine linen and hung it in the courtyard to dry. I often allowed Delilah to leave the cramped animal pen and wander free in the courtyard as long as the compound gate was locked. I never dreamed she would eat Judith's cloth. Delilah, however, ate every bit of it. Mary laughed. Then we all laughed. There was a vast relief in it, as if the air had grown more spacious. Was laughter grieving, too? Martha poured the last of the wine into our cups. We were exhausted, devastated, wishing for the numbness of sleep. But we went on sitting there, reluctant to part, our togetherness like a refuge. It was nearing the midnight watch when a voice called from the gate. "It's John, a disciple of Jesus." "John," cried Mary of Magdala, leaping up to accompany Lazarus to the gate. "What urgency could bring him here so late at night and on the Sabbath?" said Martha. John stepped into the glow of our lamps and peered around the circle of faces, his eyes lingering on me, and I realized I'd seen him before. He'd been one of the four fishermen who'd traveled home with Jesus from Capernaum all those years ago, and talked in the courtyard late into the night. Young, gangly, and beardless then, now he was a broad-shouldered man with thoughtful, deep-set eyes and a beard that curled under his chin. Studying him closer, I realized I'd also seen him earlier today on Golgotha. He was the man who'd approached Jesus as he hung on the cross, and who, like me, had been turned back by the soldiers. I offered him a sorrowful smile. He was the disciple who'd stayed. He settled himself on the courtyard tiles while Martha muttered absently about the empty wineskins, finally setting a cup of water before her guest. "What has brought you here?" asked Mary of Bethany. His gaze shifted to me, and his face turned grave. Wedged between Mary and Tabitha, I reached for their hands. "Judas is dead," John said. "He hanged himself from a tree." 7. Shall I confess? Part of me had wished my brother dead. When Judas had turned Jesus over to the temple guard, he'd breached some sacred boundary in me. I'd offered him that gesture of pity as he'd stood in the distance on Golgotha, but in the aftermath, it was mostly hatred I felt. In those blank, bewildered moments, as Mary and Salome and the others waited for me to respond to the news of Judas's death, it occurred to me that Jesus would attempt to love even the lost, murderous Judas. Once, when I'd ranted to him about some slight Judith had done to me and declared my loathing of her, he'd said, "I know, Anna. She is difficult. You don't have to feel love for her. Only try to act with love." But he was Jesus, and I was Anna. I wasn't ready to let go of my animosity toward Judas. I would do so in time, but right now, it saved me. It left less room inside for pain. The silence went on too long. No one seemed to know what to say. At last, Mary of Bethany said, "Oh, Anna, this day is a desolation for you. First your husband, now your brother." Something about these words caused a flash of indignation. as if Jesus and Judas could be mentioned in the same sentence, as if the loss I felt over them could be compared. But she meant well, I knew that. I stood and smiled at them. Your presence has been my only solace this day, but I'm overcome now with weariness and will retire to sleep. I bent and kissed Mary and Salome. Tabitha rose and followed me. I curled onto the mat in Tabitha's room, but could find no sleep. Hearing me toss about, my friend began to play her lyre, hoping to draw me into sleep. As the music moved through the darkness, grief rose in me. For my beloved, but also for my brother. Not for the Judas who betrayed Jesus, but for the boy who pined for his parents, who endured our father's rejection, who took me with him when he walked in the Galilean hills, and who always took my part. I mourned the Judas who gave my bracelet to the injured laborer, who burned Nathanael's date grove, who resisted Rome. Those were the Judases I loved. For them I buried my face in the crook of my arm and cried. 8. When I woke the following morning, the sky was white with sun. Tabitha's mat was empty, and the smell of baking bread floated everywhere. I sat up, surprised at the lateness, forgetting for a single blissful moment the ruin of the previous day. And then all of it returned, winding itself around my ribs until I could barely breathe. Once again, I wished for my aunt. I could hear the women out in the courtyard, their soft, droning voices, but it was Yaltha I wanted. I stood at the doorway trying to imagine what she would say to me if she were here. Several minutes passed before I allowed myself to remember that night in Alexandria, when Lavi brought news of John the Immerser's beheading, and I'd been overwhelmed with the fear of losing Jesus. All shall be well, Yaltha had told me, and when I'd recoiled at how trite and superficial that sounded, she'd said, I don't mean that life won't bring you tragedy. I only mean you will be well in spite of it. There's a place in you that is inviolate. You'll find your way there when you need to, and you'll know then what I speak of. I pulled on Jesus's cloak and stepped outside. My feet were tender from walking barefoot on the stones of Golgotha. Lavi squatted near the oven, packing his travel pouch. I watched him layer bread, salted fish, and water skins inside it. With all that had happened, I'd forgotten he was leaving. The ship we'd arrived on would sail back to Alexandria in 3 days. In order to be on it, Lavi would set out for Joppa early tomorrow morning. The realization jarred me. Mary, Salome, Martha, Mary of Bethany, Tabitha, and Mary of Magdala were gathered in the shade near the wall overlooking the valley. Even though the Sabbath would not end until sunset, Tabitha appeared to be mending something, and Martha was kneading dough. I doubted Tabitha cared about the Sabbath law forbidding work, but Martha seemed devout about these things. When I joined them, sitting on the warm ground beside my mother-in-law, Martha said, Yes, I know. I'm committing a sin, but I find consolation in baking bread. I wanted to say, if I had ink and papyrus, I would gladly sin along with you. Instead, I gave her my most commiserative smile. Peering at Tabitha, I saw that she was sewing my sandal. Mary said, We'll return to the tomb tomorrow after first light to finish anointing Jesus. Mary and Martha have provided us with aloe, cloves, mint, and frankincense. I'd said what felt like my final goodbye to Jesus the day before, when I'd kissed his cheeks in the tomb. It unsettled me to think of repeating the wrenching process of leaving him again, but I nodded. I trust one of you remembers where the tomb lies, she said. I was too distraught to take notice, and there were many caves there and about. I believe I can find it, said Salome. I was careful to observe the way. Mary turned back to me. Anna, I think that you, Salome, and I should remain here in Bethany for the 7 days of mourning before we depart for Nazareth. I'll need to seek out James and Judith in Jerusalem and learn their wishes, but I'm sure they'll agree. Would this suit you? Nazareth. In my mind, I saw the mud-baked compound with the single olive tree. The tiny room where I'd lived with Jesus, where I'd birthed Susanna, where I'd hidden away my incantation bowl. I pictured the little storage room where Yaltha had slept, the hand loom on which I'd woven reams of poor cloth, and the oven where I'd baked loaves of scorched bread. The air grew very quiet. I felt Mary's stare. I felt all their stares, but I didn't look up from my lap. What would it be like to live in Nazareth again, but without Jesus? James was now the eldest, the head of the family, and it occurred to me he might decide to find me a new husband, as he had for Salome when she became a widow. And there was the threat of Antipas. In his letter, Judas had written that the danger to me in Galilee had lessened, but not fully passed. I pushed to my feet and walked a short distance from them. There was a feeling in me like rising water. It broke over me finally, leaving behind the thing I knew, but didn't know. Nazareth had never been my home. Jesus had been my home. Now, with him gone, my home was on a hillside in Egypt. It was Yaltha and Diadora. It was the Therapeuty. Where else could I write with abandon? Where but there could I tend a library and animals both? Where else could I live by the utterances of my own heart? I breathed in, and it felt like a small homecoming. Across the courtyard, I saw Lavi securing the opening of his travel pouch with a leather strap. The fear of disappointing Mary, of hurting her, of missing her, hurtled through me. She called to me. Anna, what is the matter? I walked back and sat beside her. She said, "You do not mean to return to Nazareth, do you?" I shook my head. "I will return to Egypt to live out my days with my aunt. There's a community there of spiritual seekers and philosophers. I will live among them." I said it gently but without apology. Then I waited for what she would say. She spoke with her lips close to my ear. "Go in peace, Anna, for you were born for this." Those 10 words were her greatest gift to me. "Tell us about this place where you'll live," said Salome. I felt barely composed, astonished suddenly that I would be leaving so quickly, and I was anxious to alert Lavi and begin packing my own provisions, but I did my best to enlighten them about the Therapeuty, the community that danced and sang all night, every 49th day. I described the stone huts scattered across a hillside, the lake at its foot, the cliffs at the top, and beyond them, the sea. I told them about the holy room where I'd written my own texts, and preserved them in codices, the library I was trying to restore, the song to Sophia I'd written and sung. I talked on, and I felt the longing in me for home. "Take me with you," a voice said. We all turned and looked at Tabitha. I wondered if she'd spoken in jest, but she stared at me with utmost seriousness. I didn't know how to answer. "Tabitha," Martha admonished. "You've been like a daughter to us all these years, yet on a whim you want to abandon us for a place unknown to you?" "I do not know how to explain it," Tabitha said. "I feel like I, too, am meant to be there." Her voice was thickening, syllables starting to blunt and fall away. She looked slightly frantic to make her realization understood. "But you can't just leave," said Martha. "Why can't she?" I asked. The question arrested Martha. I looked at Tabitha. "If you're serious about going, you must know that life within the Therapeuty is not only singing and dancing. There's work, fasting, study, and prayer." I didn't mention Haran and the Jewish militia who'd sought to arrest me. "You must also possess a desire for God," I told her. "Otherwise you won't be admitted. I would be wrong not to tell you these things." "I wouldn't mind finding God in this place," Tabitha said, calmer now, her words intact again. "Could I not seek him in music?" Skepsis would welcome her, I was sure of it. She would admit her based on that last question Tabitha had posed. And if not, she'd admit her for me. I can think of no reason you can't come with us, I said. Do you have money for the ship's passage? Asked Martha. Practical Martha. Tabitha's eyes widened. I used all the money I had to buy the spikenard. I calculated quickly in my head. I'm sorry, Tabitha. I only have enough drachma for Lavi's passage and my own. Why hadn't I thought about this before I encouraged her? Martha made a noise, a little harumph that sounded like triumph. Well, it's fortunate then that I have the money. She smiled at me. I don't know why she can't just leave if she chooses. My sandal lay in Tabitha's lap, repaired and ready for the long walk to Joppa. She handed it to me, then rose and embraced Martha. If I had more spikenard, I would bathe your feet, Tabitha told her. The next morning, Lavi, Tabitha, and I slipped from the house before dawn, while the others still slept. At the gate, I looked back, thinking of Mary. Let's not say goodbye, she'd told me the evening before. We shall surely see one another again. She'd said this without artifice, with a believing hope so earnest, I thought it might be true. We would, though, never see each other again. The moon was at its ebb, no more than a faint, curving crust of light. As we followed the path into the Hinnom Valley, Tabitha began to hum, unable to hide her joy. She had tied her lyre onto her back, where its curled arms peeked over her shoulders like a pair of wings. The happiness of homegoing was in me, too, but it was lodged beside my sorrow. This was the land of my husband and my daughter. Their bones would always be here. Every step away from them was a pain in my heart. Walking along Jerusalem's eastern wall, I begged the darkness to last until we passed the Roman hill where Jesus had died, but the light broke just as we approached, a sudden, harrowing brightness. I let myself take one last glimpse of Golgotha. Then I turned my gaze toward the hillsides in the distance where Jesus was buried, where the women would come soon to wrap him in sweet spices. Lake Mareotis, Egypt, 30-60 CE. 1. Tabitha and I found Yaltha in the garden, bent over a row of spindly plants. Absorbed in her work, she didn't notice us. She smeared her fingers across her tunic, leaving two trails of dirt, an act that filled me with inexplicable gladness. She was 59 now, but she looked almost youthful leaning in the sunlight among all these green-growing things, and I felt a surge of relief. She was still here. Aunt, I called. Seeing me and then Tabitha running toward her through the barley plants, she opened her mouth and dropped back onto her heels. I heard her exclaim in typical fashion, "Shit of a donkey!" I tugged Yaltha to her feet and hugged her to me. I thought I would never see you again. Nor I you, she said. Yet here you are after only a few weeks away. Her face was a jumble of elation and confusion. Then look who you've brought with you. As she embraced Tabitha, a shout came from behind us, higher on the slope. Anna? Anna, is that you? Looking back toward the cliffs, I saw Diadora racing down the path, with a basket jostling in her arms, and I knew she'd been up there collecting motherwort. She reached us breathless, her hair sprung from her scarf into a riotous fan around her face. She swung me about, sending the spiky-leaved herbs flying. When I introduced her to Tabitha, she said a priceless thing that Tabitha would remember all her life. Anna has told me of your bravery. Tabitha said nothing in response, which I imagined Diadora perceived as shyness, but I knew her silence was about the severed tongue in her mouth, her fear of sounding senseless. Tabitha helped Diadora gather the spilled herbs, and all the while Yaltha waited to ask the question, the one I dreaded. I looked out across the hillside, searching for the roof of the library. What has brought you back, child? Yaltha said. Her face looked grave and stony. She'd already guessed the reason. Jesus is dead, I said, feeling how my voice wanted to splinter apart. They crucified him. Diadora let out a cry that I felt inside my own throat. Yaltha took my hand. Come with me, she said. She led us to a little knoll not far from the garden, where we sat beside a cluster of brush pines that had been sculpted into outlandish shapes by the wind. Tell us what happened, Yaltha said. I was weary from travel. We'd trekked for 2.5 days from Bethany to Joppa, sailed another 6 to Alexandria, then jostled for hours in a donkey-pulled wagon that Lavi had hired. But I told the story. I told them everything. And like before with the women in Bethany, it took some of the brightness from my pain. When the story was spent, we fell silent. Far down the escarpment, I could just make out a slice of blue lake. Nearby, one of my goats was bleeding in the animal shed. It was a relief to see that Haran's soldiers are no longer encamped on the road, I said. They disbanded not long after you left, Yaltha said. It happened exactly as Skepsis predicted. Haran was quickly informed that you'd returned to your husband in Galilee, and that I'd taken the vows to remain among the Therapeuti for life. Shortly after that, the outpost was abandoned. Returned to your husband in Galilee. The words were like little cleavers. I noticed Tabitha open and close her fists, as if coaxing the bravery Diadora had spoken about. Then she spoke for the first time. Anna said, "The outpost would likely be deserted. But Lavi would not take chances. He insisted we wait in the closest village while he rode on alone to be certain. Only then did he return for us." She spoke slowly, molding the sounds in her mouth. As she'd spoken, though, a new concern had clamored at me. "Won't Lucian inform Haran I'm back?" I asked Yaltha. Yaltha pressed her lips together and pondered this for the first time herself. "You're right about Lucian. He will most certainly inform Haran you're back. But even if Haran decides once again to seek our arrests, he would have a hard time convincing the soldiers to return. Before you left, there were rumors of their discontent. They'd grown weary searching passers-by and receiving little pay for it. And Haran is bound to resist doling out more of his money to them." She laid her hand on my knee. "I think his revenge will go no further. But either way, we're safe here with the Therapeuti. We can wait to venture beyond the gatehouse after Haran dies. The man is older than me. He can't live forever." A wicked grin formed on Yaltha's face. "We could always write a death curse for him." "I'm very good at composing them," said Tabitha, who may or may not have grasped our lack of seriousness. "I took the vows," Yaltha said. "I'm one of them for life now." I would never have expected this. She'd spent so much of her life rootless, exiled to places not of her choosing. Now she chose. "Oh, Aunt, I'm glad for you." "I took them too," said Diadora. I said, "I will do so as well." "And I," said Tabitha. Yaltha smiled at her. "Tabitha, dear, in order to take the vows, you'll need to be here for more than 5 minutes." Tabitha laughed. "Next week, then," she said. We rose finally to walk down the hill to find Skepsis and inform her of our return. But we paused first, listening to a bell clang in the distance. Wind was pouring down the cliffs, bringing the smell of the sea, and the air glowed with the saffron light that came sometimes on cloudless days. I remember this small interlude as if it were a sacred occasion, for I looked at the three of them poised before the brush pines, and I saw that we had somehow shaped ourselves into a family. 2. In the middle of the afternoon, 22 months, 1 week, and a day after Jesus' death, rain thundered onto the library roof, waking me from a strange and unintended sleep. My head felt full and fuzzy, like it was stuffed with heaps of newly shorn wool. Lifting my cheek from my writing desk, I looked about. Where was I? Gaius, who'd once nailed me into a coffin, had recently built a second room onto the library, so I would have a scriptorium and space for cubicles to hold the library's scrolls. But in those first muddled seconds of waking, I didn't recognize the new surroundings. I felt a flicker of panic inside, and then, of course, my whereabouts in the world returned. Later, I would think of my old friend Thaddeus, who'd slept every day in the scriptorium in Haran's house, practically curled up on top of his desk, napping out of boredom and for a time from Yaltha's spiked beer. I, however, could only blame my somnolence on the passion that had driven me to work late into the night for weeks, making copies of my codices. 2 copies for the library, and another that could be disseminated. I pushed the bench back from my desk and shook my head, trying to clear the drowsy after effect, but the cobwebs clung to me. As I'd slept, the room had darkened and chilled, and I pulled Jesus' cloak around my shoulders, drew the lamp closer, and turned my attention back to my work. My codex, Thunder, Perfect Mind, lay open on the desk, and beside it was the copy I'd been making of it on a fresh sheet of papyrus. Skepsis planned to send the copy to a scholar at the library in Alexandria, with whom she corresponded. I'd taken extra care with the lettering and added my small flourishes, but my chevrons and spirals were wasted. A large, messy ink smear gaped at me from the middle of the papyrus, the place where my face had rested on the manuscript when I'd fallen asleep. The last lines I'd written were barely legible. I am the whore and the holy woman. I am the wife and the virgin. I rubbed my finger across my cheek, and the tip of it came back with a smear of ink. It seemed ironic, sad, beautiful, almost purposeful, that I am the wife had been smudged onto my skin. For nearly 2 years, I'd worn my grief for Jesus like a second skin. In all that time, the pain of his absence had not diminished. The familiar burning came to my eyes, followed by that sense I often got of wandering inside my heart, desperately searching for what I could never find, my husband. I feared my grief would turn to despair, that it would become a skin I couldn't shed. A great tiredness came over me then. I closed my eyes, wanting the dark, empty void. I woke to silence. The rain had quieted. The air seemed weighted and still. Looking up, I saw Jesus standing across the room, his dark, expressive eyes staring at me. I drew in my breath. It took several minutes before I could speak. I said, "Jesus, you've come." "Anna," he said. "I never left." And he smiled his funny, lopsided smile. He didn't move from where he stood, so I walked toward him, stopping suddenly when I noticed he was wearing his old cloak with the bloodstain on the sleeve. I looked down, taking in the garment draped about my shoulders, his old cloak with the bloodstain on the sleeve, the one I'd worn daily for 22 months, 1 week, and a day. How could he be wearing it too? I tried to discern what was happening. This was most assuredly a dream, I thought, perhaps an awake dream or a vision. Yet I felt the realness of him. I went and clutched his hands. They were warm and calloused. He smelled like sweat and wood chips. His beard bore traces of limestone dust. He looked as he had when we were together in Nazareth. I wondered what he thought of the ink on my cheek. I sensed he was leaving. "Don't go." "I'll always be with you," he said. And he vanished. I sat at my desk a long while trying to comprehend. Skepsis had once told me her mother appeared in her holy room 3 weeks after she'd died. "It's not an uncommon thing," she'd said. "The mind is a mystery." I believed then, and still now, that Jesus' visitation was the workings of my own mind, but it was no less a miracle than if he'd been flesh and blood. His spirit returned to me that day. He was no longer lost to me. I removed his cloak, folded it neatly, and tucked it into an empty cubicle. I said aloud to the shadows in the room, "All shall be well." 3. We climb the path to the cliffs, Diodora, Tabitha, and I, walking one behind the other in the orange light. I walk at the head, holding my incantation bowl against my chest. Behind me, Diodora strikes a goatskin drum, and Tabitha sings a song about Eve the Seeker. For 30 years, the three of us have lived together on this hillside. I glance over my shoulder at them. Tabitha's hair flutters out behind her in the breezes, smooth and gray as a dove wing, and Diodora's face has become a tiny field of furrows like her mother's. We keep no mirrors, but I often see my reflection on the water's surface, the crinkling around my eyes, my hair still dark except for a streak of white across the front. At 58, I can still move with quickness and ease up the steep incline, as can my two sisters. But today we walk slowly, weighed down by the bulging pouches on our backs. They are stuffed full of codices, 30 leather-bound copies of my writings, all the words I've written since I was 14, my everything. Nearing the cliff tops, we veer off the footpath and pick our way over rocks and wind-bowed grasses until we arrive at the spot I've selected, a little plateau surrounded by flowering marjoram bushes. I set my incantation bowl on the ground. Diodora stops drumming, Tabitha ceases her song, and we stand there, staring at two mammoth clay jars that are nearly as tall as I am, and then at two deep round holes that have been dug side by side in the earth. I peer into one of the holes, and a mingling of elation and sadness passes through me. We peel the heavy pouches from our backs, sighing with relief, making little grunting noises. "Did you have to write so much over the course of your life?" Diodora teases. Pointing at the little mountain of soil that was dug from the holes, she adds, "I imagine the junior who was required to dig these bottomless pits would also like an answer to that." Tabitha circumambulates one of the clay jars as if it's the size of Mount Sinai. "The poor donkeys who bore these Goliath jars up here would like the question answered as well." "Very well," I say, joining in their fun. "I'll write an exhaustive answer to the question, and we shall return and dig another hole and bury that writing too." They groan loudly. Tabitha no longer hides her grin. She says, "Woe to us, Diodora. Now that Anna is leader of the Therapeuti, we have no choice but to obey her." We look at one another and break into laughter. I'm unsure whether it's because of the weight and volume of my books or because I have indeed become the Therapeuti's leader. At that moment, both of these things seem remarkably funny to us. Our levity fades as we remove the codices from the pouches. We grow quiet, even solemn. The day before, I cut Jesus' cloak into 31 pieces. Now, sitting beside the holes dug into the hillside, we wrap the fragments of cloth around the books to protect them from dust and time, and tie them with undyed yarn. We work quickly, listening to the sea slap against the rocks far below, to the marjoram bushes alive with honeybees, the vibrating world. When the task is done, I stare at the wrapped codices neatly stacked beside the jars, and they look like they're wearing little shrouds. I shake away the image, but the worry that my work will be forgotten lingers. Earlier, I recorded exactly where the jars would be buried, writing the location on a sealed scroll that will be passed on within the community after I die. But how long before the scroll is forgotten, before the significance of what's buried fades? I take the incantation bowl in my hands and lift it over my head. Diodora and Tabitha watch as I rotate it in slow circles and chant the prayer I wrote as a girl. The longing in it still seems like a living, breathing thing. As I sing the words, I remember the night on the roof when Yaltha presented the bowl to me. She tapped the bone over my chest, striking it to life. "Write what's inside here, inside your holy of holies," she told me. Yaltha fell asleep beneath the tamarisk tree in the courtyard 4 years ago at the age of 85, and never woke up. She had all sorts of things to say to me during her life, but at her death, there were no parting words. Our last real conversation had taken place beneath that same tree the week before she died. "Anna," she said, "do you remember when you buried your scrolls in the cave to prevent your parents from burning them?" I looked at her with curiosity. "I remember." "Well, you must do so again. I want you to make a copy of each of your codices and bury them on the hillside near the cliffs." Her left hand possessed an occasional tremor, and she'd become increasingly unsteady on her feet, but her mind, her glorious mind, had always been sound. I frowned. "But why, Aunt? My work is safe here. No one is coming to burn it." Her voice sharpened. "Listen to me, Anna. You've dared much with your words. So much that a time will come when men will try to silence them. The hillside will keep your work safe." I simply stared at her, trying to make sense of her pronouncement. My face must have been ridden with doubt. "You're not listening," she said. "Think what you've written." I scrolled through them in my head. Stories of the matriarchs, the rape and maiming of Tabitha, the terrors men inflicted on women, the cruelties of Antipas, the braveries of Phasaelus, my marriage to Jesus, the death of Susanna, the exile of Yaltha, the enslavement of Diodora, the power of Sophia, the story of Isis, thunder, perfect mind, and a plethora of other ideas about women that turned traditionally held beliefs upside down. And these were only a portion. "I don't understand," I broke off, because I did understand. I just didn't want to. "Copies of your writings are gradually being dispersed," she said. "They shed a beautiful light, but they will unsettle people and threaten their certainties. There'll come a time, mark down my words, I foresee it, when men will try to destroy what you've written." I'd always been the one who had moments of prescience, not Yaltha. It seemed unlikely she'd divined a glimpse of the future, and more likely she spoke from wisdom and prudence. She smiled, but there was a firm, urgent quality about her. "Bury your writings, so one day they can be found again." "I promise, Aunt, I'll make certain that day comes." "When I am dust, sing these words over my bones. She was a voice." I chant the last line of the prayer in my bowl, and together, Diodora, Tabitha, and I lower the jars onto their sides and place the codices inside, 15 in each one. Reaching into my pouch, I remove the mummy portrait I commissioned all those years ago as a gift for Jesus, meant to preserve my memory. The three of us stare at it a moment, my face painted on a piece of limewood board. I carried it all the way to Galilee to give him, but I was too late. I will always regret that lateness. I fold the last remnant of Jesus' cloak around the portrait and slip it into the jar, thinking with wonder how his memory is being preserved 3 decades after his death. The past few years, Lavi has brought bits of news to me from Alexandria about Jesus' followers, who didn't disappear when Jesus died, but grew in number. Lavi says small groups of them have even sprung up here in Egypt, meeting in homes, telling stories about Jesus, and imparting his parables and sayings. How I would like to hear the stories they tell. "They speak of Jesus as having had no wife," Lavi told me. That was a conundrum I puzzled over for months. Was it because I was absent when he traveled about Galilee during his ministry? Was it because women were so often invisible? Did they believe making him celibate rendered him more spiritual? I found no answers, only the sting of being erased. We seal the lids with beeswax, and with a grand effort, lower the jars into the earth. On our knees, we rake the pebbly soil into the holes with our hands, filling them. "The codices are buried, Aunt. I've kept my promise." We stand, brushing away the dust, catching our breath. and it comes to me that the echoes of my own life will likely die away in that way thunder does. But this life, what a shining thing. It is enough. The sun slips from the sky, and the dark gold light rises up. I gaze into the far distance and sing. I am Anna. I was the wife of Jesus of Nazareth. I am a voice.
Author's note. It was an October morning in 2014 when the idea struck me to write a novel about the fictional wife of Jesus. 15 years earlier, I'd thought of writing such a novel, but it hadn't seemed the right time, and honestly, I couldn't muster quite enough audacity then to take it on. But that day in October, a decade and a half later, the idea resurfaced with a great deal of insistence. I made a weak effort to talk myself out of it. Centuries of tradition insisted Jesus was unmarried, and that position had long been codified into Christian belief and embedded in the collective mind. Why tamper with that? But it was really too late to dissuade myself. My imagination had been captured. I'd already begun to picture her. Within minutes, she had a name, Anna. I have a habit of propping signs on my desk. This one remained there throughout the 4.5 years I researched and wrote the novel. Everything is the proper stuff of fiction. Virginia Woolf. The aim of the novelist is not only to hold up a mirror to the world, but to imagine what's possible. The Book of Longings reimagines the story that Jesus was a single celibate bachelor and imagines the possibility that at some point he had a wife. Of course, Christian New Testament scripture does not say he was married, but neither does it say he was single. The Bible is silent on the matter. If Jesus had a wife, it would be recorded in the Bible, someone explained to me. But would it? The invisibility and silencing of women were real things. Compared to men in Jewish and Christian scriptures, women rarely have speaking parts, and they are not mentioned nearly as often. If they are referenced, they're often unnamed. It could also be argued that in the first century Jewish world of Galilee, marriage was so utterly normative, it more or less went without saying. Marriage was a man's civic, family, and sacred duty, typically undertaken at 20, though sometimes up to age 30. Marriage was how he became an adult male and established himself within his community. His family expected him to marry and would have been shocked, perhaps even shamed, if he didn't. His religion dictated that he not abstain from having a wife. Of course, it's possible Jesus defied these imperatives. There is evidence that ascetic ideals were beginning to encroach into first-century Judaism. And, too, he could be something of a nonconformist at times. But I saw more reason to think that at the age of 20, a decade before his ministry began, Jesus did not reject the religious and cultural ethic of his time and place. Claims that Jesus was not married first began in the second century. They arose as Christianity absorbed ideas of asceticism and Greek dualism, which devalued the body and the physicality of the world in favor of the spirit. Closely identified with the body, women were also devalued, silenced, and marginalized, losing roles of leadership they'd possessed within first-century Christianity. Celibacy became a path to holiness. Virginity became one of Christianity's higher virtues. Certain that the end time would come soon, believers in the second century hotly debated if Christians should marry. Considering the accretion of such views into the religion, it struck me as not particularly acceptable for Jesus to have been married. Perceptions like these allowed me to move outside of traditional ecclesiastical boxes and begin to imagine the character of a married Jesus. Of course, I don't know whether Jesus was married or not. There are reasons just as compelling to support the belief he remained single. Unless some genuine ancient manuscript is discovered buried in a jar somewhere, and it reveals that Jesus had a wife, we simply cannot know. Even then, the matter would likely be irresolvable. Yet from that first moment of inspiration to write this story, I felt the importance of imagining a married Jesus. Doing so provokes a fascinating question. How would the Western world be different if Jesus had married and his wife had been included in his story? There are only speculative answers, but it seems plausible that Christianity and the Western world would have had a somewhat different religious and cultural inheritance. Perhaps women would have found more egalitarianism. Perhaps the relationship between sexuality and sacredness would have been less fractured. Celibacy among the priesthood might not exist. I wondered what, if any, effect imagining the possibility of a married Jesus could have on these traditions. How does imagining new possibilities affect realities in the present? I am deeply and reverentially aware that Jesus is a figure to whom millions of people are devoted, and that his impact on the history of Western civilization is incomparable, affecting non-Christians and Christians both. Given that, it may be useful to comment on how I went about writing his character. It was clear to me from the beginning that I would portray Jesus as fully human. I wanted the story to be about Jesus the man and not God the Son, who he would become. Early Christianity debated whether Jesus was human or divine, a matter it settled in the 4th century at the Council of Nicaea, and again at the Council of Chalcedon in the 5th century, when doctrines were adopted stating Jesus was fully human and fully divine. Nevertheless, his humanity diminished as he became more and more glorified. Writing from a novelist perspective and not a religious one, I was drawn to his humanity. There's no record of Jesus from the age of 12 until the age of 30. His presence in the novel coincides in part with this unrecorded time period, with two notable exceptions: his baptism and his death. I invented the actions and words of Jesus during the unknown years, the only way I could, through conjecture and reasonable extrapolation. My portrayal of Jesus comes from my own interpretation of who he was, based on my research of the historical Jesus and first century Galilee and Judea, on scriptural accounts of his life and teachings, and on other commentaries about him. It was something of a wonder to discover that the human Jesus has so many different faces, and that people, even historical Jesus scholars, tend to view him through the lens of their own experience and proclivities. For some, he's a political activist. For others, a miracle worker. He's viewed as a rabbi, social prophet, religious reformer, wisdom teacher, nonviolent revolutionary, philosopher, feminist, apocalyptic preacher, and on and on. How would I fashion Jesus' character? I envisioned him in his 20s as a thoroughly Jewish man, living under Roman occupation, and as a husband, working to support his family, but harboring an evolving pull inside to leave and begin a public ministry. I depicted him as a mamzer, that is, one who suffers some degree of ostracism, in Jesus' case, because of his questioned paternity. I also visualized Jesus as an emerging social prophet and a rabbi whose dominant message was love and compassion and the coming of God's kingdom, which initially he viewed as an eschatological event establishing God's rule on earth, and ultimately as a state of being within the hearts and minds of people. I saw him as a nonviolent political resistor who takes on the role of Messiah, the promised Jewish deliverer. And central to the character I've drawn is Jesus' empathy for the excluded, the poor, and outcast of all kinds, as well as his uncommon intimacy with his God. It feels important to point out that the character of Jesus in these pages provides a mere glimpse of the complexity and fullness of who he was. And that glimpse is based on my interpretation of him, which is woven into a fictional narrative. The story is imagined, but I've tried, through extensive research, to be true to its historical, cultural, political, and religious backdrop. There are instances, though, in which I veer from the record or from accepted tradition for narrative purposes. The more noteworthy incidences follow. Herod Antipas moved the capital of Galilee from Sepphoris to Tiberias, somewhere around 18 to 20 CE. In the novel, this move didn't take place until 23 CE. Sepphoris, a wealthy city of approximately 30,000, was a mere 4 miles from Nazareth, prompting many scholars to speculate that Jesus was exposed to a sophisticated, Hellenized, multilingual world. Scholars also conjecture that Jesus and his father Joseph, both of whom were builders, may have found contract work in Sepphoris as Herod Antipas rebuilt the city during Jesus' adolescent years. It's unlikely, though, that he would have found work on the Roman theater as portrayed in the novel. According to a number of archaeologists, the theater was constructed close to the end of the first century, decades after Jesus' death. The mosaic of Anna's face in Antipas' palace was inspired by an actual mosaic found on the floor of an excavated mansion in Sepphoris. Known as Mona Lisa of the Galilee, it is an exquisite depiction of a woman's face that dates to the 3rd century. Phasaelis, the first wife of Herod Antipas, was a Nabatean princess who covertly escaped back to her father in the Arabian kingdom of Nabatea when she learned that Antipas planned to take Herodias as his wife. The exact year she fled is debated, but I've almost certainly predated it by several years. Christian scripture states that Jesus had 4 named brothers and multiple unnamed sisters. I could only make room in the story for 2 brothers and 1 sister. My representation of James is likely harsher than he deserves, though in New Testament scripture it does appear there was some conflict between Jesus and his brothers during Jesus' ministry. James later became a follower of Jesus after his brother's death and the leader of the Jerusalem church. In the scriptures, Jesus appears at the Jordan River to be baptized by John the Baptist, then immediately goes off into the wilderness, after which he begins his ministry. I've imagined, however, that after his baptism and retreat into the wilderness, Jesus spent some months as one of John's followers. While there's no mention of this in Scripture, there are conjectures by some scholars that Jesus was likely one of John's followers and was deeply influenced by him, a premise I adopted. Mary of Bethany is the woman named in the New Testament scripture as anointing Jesus' feet with an expensive ointment shortly before his death, an event that elicited criticism from Judas. I took the liberty of having Anna's friend, Tabitha, perform this act of anointing instead. In the novel, Anna rushes to Jesus on the street when he falls beneath the weight of the crossbeam. This deviates from a long-held, non-scriptural tradition that a woman named Veronica went to him and wiped his face when he fell. The Gospels in the New Testament describe Jesus as arriving in Bethany and Jerusalem in Judea the week before his death. However, in order to accommodate the timeline of the story, I had them arrive a number of weeks before the crucifixion. I've attempted to adhere to the biblical stories of Jesus' trial, crucifixion, and burial, though not all of the occurrences in these stories could be incorporated. The inclusion or absence of events depends on whether or not they are witnessed or discovered by Anna, the narrator. In the novel, Anna and a group of women walk with Jesus to his execution, remain there as he's crucified, and then prepare him for burial. The Gospels give somewhat differing accounts of his death, but they all record the presence of a group of women at his crucifixion. Jesus' mother and Mary Magdalene are listed among them. Salome, Jesus' sister, and Mary of Bethany are not mentioned, but I inserted them in place of two other women who were. The scene in the novel in which the women walk with Jesus to his crucifixion is my invention. The Therapeutae was not a figment of my imagination, but a real monastic-like community near Lake Mareotis in Egypt, where Jewish philosophers devoted themselves to prayer and study and a sophisticated allegorical interpretation of Scripture, thriving during the time period in the novel. The group is represented in these pages with a significant amount of factual detail. The 49th day vigils, with their delirious all-night singing and dancing, did indeed take place. The holy rooms in their small stone houses existed, as did female members and a devotion to Sophia, the feminine spirit of God. However, the Therapeutae's practice of asceticism and solitude was far more prevalent and intense than I describe. In the story, I refer to their fasting and solitude, but I essentially reimagine the group as more interactive and body-friendly. The Thunder, Perfect Mind, is an actual document written by an unknown author believed to be female and dated within the novel's time frame. Its 9 pages of papyrus were among the famous Nag Hammadi texts discovered in 1945 in a jar buried in the hills above the Nile in Egypt. In the novel, Thunder, Perfect Mind is authored by Anna, who composes it as a hymn to Sophia. The passages of it that are included in the novel are from the real poem. I've read and reread this poem for 2 decades, awed by its provocative, ambiguous, commanding, gender-bending voice. Imagining Anna creating it as her great opus simply made me happy. The author's note dwells heavily on the figure of Jesus for obvious reasons, but the story in the Book of Longings belongs to Anna. She wandered into my imagination, and I couldn't ignore her. I saw Anna not only as the wife of Jesus, but as a woman with her own quest, that of following her longings in pursuit of the largeness inside herself. I saw her, too, as a woman able to become not only Jesus' wife, but his partner. The day Anna appeared, I knew one thing about her besides her name. I knew that what she wanted most was a voice. If Jesus actually did have a wife, and history unfolded exactly the way it has, then she would be the most silenced woman in history and the woman most in need of a voice. I've tried to give her one.
This is Mojan Marnot. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Book of Longings by Sue Monk Kidd. This program was directed by Maureen Monterrubio, executive producer Diane McKiernan. Text copyright 2020 by Sue Monk Kidd, Inc. Production copyright 2020, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.